You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, and happy Monday. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Washington, D.C. And, wow, there is a lot going on today. We're going in our third hour. Mark Finkelstein is going to drop by, a contributor to Newsbusters. We're going to have an interesting debate on why is it that Republicans are so afraid to raise taxes on millionaires when, you know, for 40 years we had high taxes on millionaires and America was better off than it's ever been. I don't get it. But maybe he can enlighten us. In our second hour, I want to get into some detail. In fact, I want to really, really dig into this whole Americans Elect thing. David Gregory gave these guys a 20-minute infomercial on NBC yesterday after Meet the Press and before the presidential address. And when you find out who these folks are and what they're up to, I think it's going to make your hair stand up or straighten or curl or whatever it may be for you in particular. But it's an eye-popper. Meanwhile, today is a National Day of Action for many of the Occupy folks, and not for some of them. We're seeing different groups kind of emerge. And Joshua Holland has been following this. He's a senior writer and editor over at alternet.org. And Joshua, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Joshua. So Occupy the Ports. First of all, tell us what's going on.
Well, there is a coordinated day of action attempting to shut this morning. We've been...
Jacob, Joshua, your phone is going in and out. Is there any way that you can make it to a... You can stand in a place... I'm sorry. Joshua, I'm going to put you on hold so that you can talk to Paul. And... hopefully we can figure out a way to get a phone that works. In the meantime, I'll give you what I know about this. The Occupy Wall Street demonstrators are planning a basically blockade the ports all the way from the southern border of the United States up into Canada. There is some ambivalence between the Occupy folks and organized labor, the Longshoremen's Union. Now, part of that probably stems from the fact that the Longshoremen's Union has... contracts and is considered a national security function or whatever it may be that they can't do this kind of thing. And part of it might be that, some of them just don't agree with the Occupy folks. It's just, this is not something that the union is supporting. However, there is a teachers union supporting it, to the best of my knowledge. And one of the things that I find most interesting about this is the Goldman Sachs connection. Occupy Wall Street, of course, has been all about, if nothing else, Occupy Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs and the other five large banks, these six large banks control 65% or assets equal to 65% of the total GDP of this nation. And when you think about that, that's pretty mind-boggling stuff. And as Joshua Holland wrote about over at Alternet, Goldman Sachs Infrastructure Partners bought a 49% stake in Carrix, Inc. Carrix owns SSA Marine, which has more than 125 operations worldwide, including Los Angeles, Long Beach, Mexico, Chile, and New Zealand. And so do we have Joshua in a way that'll work now? Let's try it out. Hey, Joshua, how's your phone now?
Hey, Tom, I hope you can hear me. It's a very sprawling port, and I guess we're a little far away from the nearest cell phone tower.
Yeah, no, it sounds fine now. Literally, the last time I was getting every third word. Now I'm hearing all of them.
So it's better to get every word.
Yeah, there you go. So give us an update.
So, yes, this is a coordinated action on the West Coast as occupations attempt to shut down all of the ports. We've been here in Oakland since about 5:30 this morning. An impressive turnout for this early on a Monday morning. There were about 700 people out.
Wow.
And it looks like the Port of Oakland is shut down. Now, when rumors go around these things, you always have to take them with a grain of salt. But what I am hearing from organizers is that there is an arbitrator who is now evaluating whether this is a picket that is sufficient in size and scope to call a halt to operations. So that's kind of what we're waiting for.
In other words, consistent with union rules, you mean?
That's right. The union contract here specifically allows the longshoremen to not cross picket lines. So the question is whether the scattered people, again, this is a very sprawling port. So even though there were maybe 500 to 700 people, they are divided among several entrances. So the protesters are saying that, you know, they want to keep up a very tight picket line, and I understand that the arbitrator is evaluating right now whether to shut down operations. There's two shifts here, and the plan is for a second wave of protests in the late afternoon to block the evening shift. And we're getting reports that I can't confirm, obviously I'm out here in the port, of other ports being shut down. We understand that the port in Seattle and Portland has been shut down. We're getting conflicting reports about Los Angeles and San Diego. But anyway, Spice, this is a pretty big coordinated action out here on the West Coast.
Remarkable. Well, we're on the air live in Seattle. We're on the air live in Los Angeles. We're on the air live in Vancouver. I'm assuming that we will hear some reports from some of these places, and we'll find out what's going on with this. What's the Goldman Sachs connection? The obvious, you know, shut down the ports is... I would think, the 30 years of insane trade policies have shipped so many of our jobs overseas that there's a visceral response to that. But this apparently goes way beyond that.
Well, there's a couple of different issues. Goldman Sachs is a principal in one of the largest shipping companies in the world and controls quite a bit of it, or has a financial stake in quite a bit of it. And they're also protesting on the behalf of the union truckers, the union truckers letting non-unionized Mexican truckers in to take some of these routes. So there's a number of different issues going on here. There were questions leading up to this day about whether the longshoremen would be supportive or not of this action. I've seen one longshoreman who is very frustrated and a larger number expressing solidarity. There's a number of truckers who have been exiting and honking their horns in support of the protesters as they leave. So right. I think that's yet unclear, but it certainly hasn't been the animosity that some reports have led us to believe.
Now, would the truckers be longshoremen or would they be Teamsters?
The truckers are Teamsters, and the longshoremen are the ones who are not unloading the ships right now. And I can see that all the cranes are shut down. There's longshoremen who have reported to work, reportedly, and they are not working until clerks. There's shipping clerks that need to fill out paperwork and stuff like that. They are holding off and waiting to see what happens. So, right now, there's nothing happening. You see lines and lines of trucks idling in lines leading up to the entrances to some of these shipyards.
Right.
And
so, in the 20 seconds or so we have left, the core message of this protest, Joshua.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that it's depriving the flow of capital on the West Coast and sending a shot across the bow of the 1%.
Okay, that's a very tight and concise explanation, and well done. Thank you very much, Joshua Holland. You can read all about it over at alternet.org. Well done. Thank you, Joshua. Good talking with
Thanks
you. Glad we could get a phone line that worked. By the way, you can call in today, 866-987-THOM. We're giving away a free book, The Tom Hartman Reader, for the most interesting post on our message forums.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Today, Occupy Wall Street shutting down our ports. Will our media pay attention? We'll be right back. Yeah, I caught you doing something right alert. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 20 minutes past the hour. Our number, 866-987-THOM. That's 987-8466. And beg your pardon? Oh, and as I said, our Caught You Doing Something Right alert is all about Elizabeth Warren. Karl Rove has been running basically a lie ad in Massachusetts attacking Elizabeth Warren, saying that she was, you know, part of the banksters and she helped crash the economy, blah, 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 which is the exact opposite of the truth. And a lot of Democrats, when people like Karl Rove run ads against them, just kind of ignore them and hope they'll go away. This is what John Kerry did with the Swift boat stuff. And it hurt him terribly that he thought everybody will realize how stupid that is. Right. Saying that a guy who was a, you know, decorated war hero, you know, four times was wounded in Vietnam, that coming out and saying that he was a phony war hero, you know, he just figured nobody would believe it. He hadn't figured on the power of Fox News or the power of repetition or the power of big money or the power of the big lie, frankly. And it hurt him badly in the 2004 election. And so Elizabeth Warren is having none of that, thank you very much. Karl Rove is running these awful ads in Massachusetts saying that she participated in bringing down the banks and she was a bankster. Not saying it, but implying it so thickly that it's impossible to take any other interpretation. I mean, this is a classic example of Karl Rove doing his lie stuff, and I'm not even going to play that. But what I want to play for you is Elizabeth Warren talking back to it. This is our good on you, Elizabeth Warren. Here she is.
We must be doing something right if Karl Rove is attacking us. And boy, is he ever, with ridiculous attack ads financed by Wall Street. You know, let's be clear. Karl Rove isn't just attacking me. He and his buddies are attacking all of us in Massachusetts who want a level playing field for middle-class families. I spent years standing up to Wall Street and the big banks, exposing their tricks and traps, fighting to get a fair shake for people. No attack ad, and certainly not one from Karl Rove and Wall Street, will change that. We're building a strong grassroots organization to take them on, and I need your help. Reach out to your friends. Talk to them one-on-one. Make sure they know the truth, and ask them to go to ElizabethWarren.com and sign up. I'm Elizabeth Warren, and I approve this message, and a thank you.
There you go. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, and a few people with some thoughts on George, listening on KTLK in Los Angeles. Hey, George, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Good to talk to you. I'd like to shed some light on the port issue. I'm a Teamster driver. I've been down here in LA Long Beach for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So if there was a picket up, a Teamster would never cross it. That's the first rule. And also, it's the owner-operator situation that is the problem. In 84, the steamship lines came up with this rule and lobbied it through Congress that owner-operators cannot unionize by law. This is the problem in every harbor in America.
So a lot of the truckers are not Teamsters. They're owner-operators, are they both?
99% of them in America. Do a quick Google search. We're a Teamster company because we have a specific steamship line we have hooked up with back in the 60s, the beginning of containerization. It was called Sealand back in the day. So we've had a long-standing harbor contract forever. So we're the very small minority of the drivers down there, and we would never cross the line, of course, anyways, a sanctioned line or an unsanctioned line. But
the vast majority are operator owners. And operator owners, I'm guessing, would be, because they're paid not by the amount of time they sit in the truck,
Right. It's a gimmick between the steamship lines and the broker. The steamship lines set the rate. The broker takes 60%. Then the other 40% goes to the driver, 35 to 40%. And generally, since we're so close to the border, you can have one company have a grouping of trucks, and you can have a driver rotate in and out of there about every 6 months and call it an owner-operator. But in reality, SSA has connections with these owner-operator companies. It's all illegal what they do. But they flirt around the law so much that they get away with it.
And SSA Marine is the company that's owned by Carex, which is owned by Goldman Sachs Infrastructure Partners.
Right.
49%.
I'm in a Carex facility right now. It's called Con Global in Wilmington, waiting. They're an IEM. Workers here, but there's another thing going on with off-docking chassis product to terminals that are just outside of the harbor and obfuscating labor that way.
That's interesting. So bottom line on this thing with regard to what's going on the West Coast is that for those owner-operator drivers, if this goes on for more than a day, it's probably going to economically hurt them. The small guys, right?
Potentially it'll hurt them in the short run, but if you follow what had happened in the past, these wildcat strikes since I've been working in the harbor, the 90s, if they stopped working for 3 days, you watch the rates be driven up by 4 or 5 fold, then they start to filter back in. But it's the dynamic right. of the open border since NAFTA was signed, and you have these people running across the border, and the steamship lines taking advantage of that cheap labor. That's the dynamic. So right. if the rules were changed to be on a fair playing level with everybody, and we had
George, and this might be the thing that will change the rules. George, thanks for the call. Sorry to cut you off, but I wanted to get Anthony in here before we hit the break in about a little less than a minute. Anthony in Detroit, listening on AM 1310. Hey, Anthony.
Good morning. Yeah, you do good work. Good afternoon. Thank you for being there. I'm going to come on the heels of what the guy just went off of. What I want to talk about is that hurting, you know, with them shutting down the port, hurting ordinary average workers where they'll lose some money.
Right. Well, the Teamster drivers, it won't hurt them. For the longshoremen, I'm assuming it won't hurt them because they're showing up for work. They're just standing idle, but they're being paid. It would be the owner operators who get paid by the mile, who can't move.
I'm pretty sure. After the break.
Yeah. No. Anthony, thanks a lot for the call. I would guess that those would be the people. But we'll, you know, the bottom line here is, as with any action, you know, when people go on strike, they lose money, or there's some short term economic pain. But over the long term, if you can change the rules, you change the rules in a way that helps the 99%. That's a good thing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can drop into our live chat room over at TomHartman.com. It's running 24/7, so pretty much anytime you're listening, there should be somebody dropping by there. And some of the finest minds in the world.
Please don't you rock my boat. 'Cause I don't want my boat to be rocking anyhow.
So a lot happened over the weekend. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, we're going to be giving away an autographed copy of my new book, The Tom Hartman Reader, to Louise's favorite post today on our message boards. So you can check that out at TomHartman.com and, you know, make a, you know, post a message, post a reply, post, you know, whatever you'd like and get in the running, as it were. President Obama, first of all, was on 60 Minutes. And this is clip number two, Jacob. I thought this was a really, and in fact, this was Jacob's favorite clip. I think this was a really insightful comment and one that we all need to hear. Here it is.
I always believe this was a long-term project, that reversing a culture here in Washington dominated by special interests. It's going to take more than a year. It's going to take more than 2 years. It's going to take more than one term. Probably takes more than one president. I'm a persistent son of a gun. I just stay at it.
Yeah. So a lot to talk about, a lot of topics here today. And, you know, your thoughts on any of them, frankly, are fine. Over the weekend, 55 patriots were arrested in an early morning raid in the Occupy San Francisco encampment. When it comes to privacy, that, you know, that in and of itself. And then, of course, there's the Occupy the West Coast that's going on. Next, when it comes to privacy, we're screwed. Did you get this story? The three guys were stealing cattle from a farm in North Dakota. Now, you know, I'm not, you know, in with the cattle rustlers. I mean, you know, it's not what I'm all about is stealing cattle. I don't, you know, I'm not, there's no way that you can say, well, you know, maybe they were justified in doing it. Or, I mean, maybe there is, but not that I know of. But they got busted because they were seen by predator drones in the skies above North Dakota. Say what? Now, the only thing that makes this maybe acceptable, and I'm not sure that even this makes it acceptable, is that back in 2006 or 2005, during the criminal Bush administration, the who gives a rat's patootie about, you know, the Peace, Justice, and the American Way Bush administration, that a law was passed that said on our northern and southern borders to stop smuggling and illegal immigration and basically, you know, behave, traffic across the borders that's trying to get around the points along those borders where customs and immigration are, that predator drones can be deployed and were. And so it's possible, I mean, North Dakota has a border with Canada, so it's possible that this drone was up there looking for guys who were, you know, crossing the border illegally, and they just happened to be rustling these cattle, and that's why they got nailed. Don't know. But one of the comments that was made by Rial Kahlo, Director of Privacy and Robotics at Stanford University, is that, you know, the door has been opened, basically, and this is not what he said, this is what I'm saying, but, you know, basically the door has been opened to drones over the United States. And he said, anytime you have a tool like that in the hands of law enforcement that makes it easier to do surveillance, they will do more of it. Right. What you're looking at is the rise of the military-industrial complex, the militarization of our police. And what's the chant from Occupy Wall Street? This is what a police state looks like. John in North Hollywood. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, are you getting better?
Yeah, I'm great, but I'm getting better. What's up, John?
Good. I heard that blurb of President Obama now talking about, you know, takes time to reform. And I think that's a lot of foot-dragging nonsense because he is part of the system. He can't reform himself. I don't believe he can pull himself and us out up by our own bootstraps. That's what this Occupy movement is all about, changing the process, changing the system, not just reforming it into some new, kinder, gentler type of nonsense.
Yeah, putting a velvet glove over the iron fist of the system. Broadly speaking, I don't disagree with you in a vacuum, but here's the fundamental reality, John, and that is that politicians don't lead. They don't sit down and say, okay, I'm going to make the decision to fundamentally change this country as Obama promised he would in the campaign of 2008. They have to have a parade pushing them. They have to have the wind pushing them. They have to have a parade that they can jump out in front of with a flag. And basically what it looks like happened to me was two things after the election of 2008 and you know, in January 2009 when Obama was sworn into office. One, he had enormous political capital and enormous power at that point in time. And he could have gone down the FDR route and made those radical changes. And he would have taken enormous brickbats for that, you know, or some other euphemism that you can't say on the radio. But he could have done it, or possibly. The problem that he had with really making fundamental change, I mean, you know, large-scale change, rolling back the crimes of the Bush administration, going after the crimes of the Bush administration, rolling back, you know, so many of those things. One of the problems that he would have had is that he had a bunch of Democrats in the Senate. He didn't have, you know, 60 votes in the Senate because he had a bunch of Democrats in the Senate or people like Joe Lieberman, who's an independent, who was caucusing with the Democrats, who really weren't on his side. And Blanche Lincoln and Mary Landrieu and not so much Mary, but certainly Blanche Lincoln, you know, who got kicked out 2 years ago because of that. And at the top of that list, in my mind, is Ben Nelson. And so how do you make those kinds of changes if you don't have absolutely overwhelming support? It seems to me that what's happening now is that the parade is underway. On the right, the parade was the Tea Party, and look at what that little thing did with, you know, taking over the House of Representatives. On the left, as it were, or frankly, I think in the middle, because this the positions that that Occupy Wall Street are taking, by and large, whether it's anti-corporate personhood or let's raise taxes, let's roll back the Bush tax cuts. In fact, let's roll back the Reagan tax cuts and go back to tax policies that worked in this country. Let's go back to trade policies that worked in this country. Those positions are positions that and strengthen Social Security and Medicare, rebuild the social safety net, undo much of Clinton's welfare reform so that For example, this woman who just went to prison for 3 years in California because she applied for food stamps and neglected to mention that she had been convicted of a crime. Let's undo that stuff, right? I don't think that he could have done that 3 years ago, or maybe he could have done it, but it would have burned through an enormous amount of political capital. I'm not trying to make excuses for him. I think he missed a revolutionary moment and opportunity and then lost it in the 2010 election. So either he's going to get it back and do it after the next election, or he's going to be facing a revolution in this country. And I think that what we're seeing is this is the early stages of it, the Occupy movement. Disagree? No? Oh, John's calling.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, you didn't cut me off. Okay.
No, I didn't. I've just been talking. I appreciate your listening,
again, you're saying that he has a opportunity to make it enough of a change.
No, I'm agreeing with you that he had an opportunity and he blew it. Right now, he doesn't have the opportunity.
He doesn't have an opportunity, sir, because precisely he is the president of this system. And just like his pastor said before he even became installed into the White House, he may like him right now, but once he becomes president, he will oppose him. It is not about the man, it's about the office, and it's about the office of a system that is nonsense. He cannot change himself any more than Newt Gingrich can be a decent husband, okay?
Under most, well, first of all, and Newt pointed out over the weekend that he's 68 years old now, which was his way of saying that, you know, he's not going to be having any more affairs with 30-year-olds, but
anyway,
broadly, I'm not disagreeing with you, you know, on the principle, but consider the larger issue. Every 80 years in the United States, there is a revolutionary moment. 80 years ago is the Great Depression. It's brought about by an economic disaster. Today, Paul Krugman, the lead sentence in his New York Times piece, it's time to start calling the current situation what it is, a depression. 80 years ago was the Great Depression of the 1930s. It led to revolutionary change in the hands of Franklin Roosevelt. 80 years before that was the Great Depression of 1857. It led to revolutionary change in the hands of Abraham Lincoln. In fact, I would say that Abraham Lincoln blew it because he went into his presidency with a, shall we say, bipartisan, whatever, you know, Doris Kearns Goodwin has documented it very well. He brought a bunch of his enemies into his cabinet. He dithered about, you know, what was going to happen when the South seceded. He thought he could win the war in a week. And because he didn't go in strong and hard right from the get-go the way Franklin Roosevelt did, we had the Civil War. And then 80 years before the Civil War was the Great Depression of the 1760s, which led right to the Great Depression, you know, to the Revolutionary War. So I think we're at that revolutionary moment now, and we'll see how he plays it out.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Obama is also acknowledging what we've been saying for years, that the Republicans are all about destroying the economy and for political gain. I'll tell you about that right after this.
Hello, Seattle. I am an albatross.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Dizzy alert. Newt Gingrich flipped his top three flip-flops here, courtesy of the Center for American Progress's Think Progress blog. Here you go. Here we go. In a moment. On the individual.
I am four people, individuals, exactly like automobile insurance, individuals, having health insurance and being required to have health insurance.
But that is the individual mandate, is it not?
It's a variation. I do not support a mandate. I am opposed
to Obamacare. And this is 2012.
I am in support of the 26 attorney generals who have filed suit.
On climate change, Newt says.
My message, I think, is that the evidence is sufficient.
Back in 2004.
That we should move towards the most effective possible steps to reduce carbon loading of the atmosphere.
And do it urgently. Now.
And do it urgently, yeah.
We don't always see eye to eye, do we, Newt?
No, but we do agree our country must take action to address climate change.
That was a striking ad for me.
This is new now.
A lot of Republicans.
First of all, it's probably the dumbest single thing I've done in recent years. I actually don't know where the global warming is occurring. I testified against cap and trade the same day that Al Gore testified in favor.
And on Obama's intervention in Libya.
Exercise a no-fly zone this evening. Communicate to the Libyan military that Gaddafi was gone. This is a moment to get rid of him. Do it. Get it over with. I would not have intervened. I think there were a lot of other ways to affect Gaddafi. I think there are a lot of allies in the region that we could have worked with. I would not have used American and European forces.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Very, very dizzy. I don't know how else to say it. Yeah. Okay. Kirk in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Kirk, what's up?
Hi there, Tom.
Hey.
Hi, I tend to agree with you, the last caller. I just don't understand how people didn't quite get when he said at the very beginning of his term that he wants to change the tone in Washington. That is not something that could be accomplished overnight, and I'm not sure what people expected, especially when what was the first thing that the right said with Boehner and
McConnell.
Mitch McConnell, you know, I mean, what was their goal? He said that left.
Making him a one-term president. That was it.
Making him a one-term president. So yeah. Obviously he had adversarial attacks, you know, before he even could begin. And I'd rather have hope that this next term is going to be where he can make the change.
Well, here's the thing. It's not that we have to hope for the president. It's that we have to get out on the streets. We have to get into the blogs. We have to get on the telephones. We have to show up. The president, a member of Congress, a member of the House, a member of the Senate, no politician is going to do the things that we want done unless enough of us say, this is what we want done. They have to feel that they are protected and insulated and pushed by us. And if they don't, they won't do it. It's that simple. They will fall back into the system. And that's why it's so, that's why I, you know, say tag your head at the end of every show. That's why activism is so important. Grassroots movements. Every political action comes at, it doesn't come from the top down. Never has, never will in any country on earth. It always comes from the bottom up. And those politicians who are smart pay attention to what's going on at the bottom, particularly when it gets big and loud. And those petitions and those politicians who aren't smart, who don't pay attention, cease to be politicians. And so, Kirk, you're spot on. Thank you very much for saying it. Chuck in Novak, Michigan. Hey, Chuck, thanks for listening to WDTW. What's up?
All right, thanks for taking my call. About the Republicans refusing to raise taxes, they are never going to do it when they have to take the blame or responsibility for doing it. They'll find a way to slip it in to get the revenue. Like, say, raising or taxing unemployment, which did not used to be taxable, things of that nature.
Well, here's what I don't get. You know, Ronald Reagan raised taxes over and over and over again. I mean, he cut taxes on rich people from 74% down to 28%. But he raised taxes on working people repeatedly, and nobody said a word.
Right. But if you go ask most of them right now, they will tell you that Ronald Reagan was a tax cutter.
Yeah,
it was a situation where he didn't have to take the blame for it.
Well,
I don't think he raised taxes, although he did.
If you're a billionaire, he was. If you're, I mean, you know, that's it's that simple. Okay, thank you very much, Chuck. Andy in Redwood City, listening on Green 960. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Yes, Tom, I just wanted to say, regarding Obama, when it came to reactionary senators, Obama always supported them. Blanche Linker against Bill Halton, Mike Bennett against Andrew Romanoff, Arlen Specter against Joe Sestak, Lieberman against Ned Lamont. Every time Obama went to the side of the reactionary, the blue dog senator. Obama is not on our side. He's for the top 1%, and you should stop trying to tell people that he's going to help us, because he's not. He's gone. He shouldn't be reelected. He should be gone.
So you'd rather have Mitt Romney or Newt Gingrich in there?
That's why we have the Occupy Wall. It doesn't work. The system is
rigged. So you'd rather have Newt Gingrich or Mitt Romney as president of the United States?
It's rigged. The system is rigged, Tom.
So,
Obama has
fixed. Okay, I got it. So you'd rather have Newt Gingrich or Mitt Romney? I mean, that's what it comes down to. And I think you completely didn't hear anything I said before. Yes, of course. Obama was supporting those people. Obama was part of the establishment. Obama is part of the establishment. He's president of the United States. He's head of the Democratic Party. And those were decisions that were being made by the party. When enough people get out in the streets, when enough people get loud enough, then politicians will respond. And I believe that we're seeing the beginning of that response. I really do. And I think it's, you know, it's an absolutely necessary thing. Jonathan in Hadley, Mass, listening to WHMP. Hey, Jonathan, got a minute to the break, to the end of the hour.
A quick minute of time. About the economy being in a depression.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a small business guy, and I happen to sell sporting goods. And the reason why I want to disagree is because everywhere you look, you see the big boxes pulling up next door. Their comp store sales are continuously up because I follow them. They're constantly expanding. So maybe I just don't understand the economy, and you can explain it, because I just don't understand how they can continue to expand and grow and flourish and kill guys like me who have really a small overhead.
Yeah, what I would say is that the depression is a depression for guys like you, for the small businessmen and women. It's a depression for average working people. We've seen wages actually drop. We've seen 56,000 families for manufacturers, 56,000 factories, go out of business in the last 10 years. It's not a depression for the top 1%, though. Up next, is democracy taking a turn to the right?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. In our first hour, we heard from Joshua Holland over at alternate.com about what he live from the port of Oakland about the Occupy the Ports movement that is going on all day today up and down the West Coast. We'll keep you up to date on that. Well, but broadly, we'll see how it shakes out. But there's and toward the end of the last hour, I got a number of callers. Well, I got a couple of callers. It was interesting. We had callers on both sides who were saying, you know, Obama, you know, he was supporting, like, Blanche Lincoln. He was supporting, you know, he's the right-wing president. And, you know, my pushback or my position on that was before we were in the streets, before the Occupy movement, I don't frankly think that Obama saw much more than the Tea Party out there. I don't think he felt that he had the it's not even a matter of he felt that he had the support. Politicians, it's not like they hope that they have the support or something like that. They get pressed. I was over the weekend listening to tapes of William Howard Taft, and I would play them for you, but the audio quality was so bad. William Howard Taft was the president who followed Teddy Roosevelt. He was a Republican. Teddy Roosevelt was a Republican. And the tapes were about how, you know, labor should have the right to organize. Labor should have the right to strike. You know, how the tariffs are a good thing for America. I mean, it was pretty amazing, actually. And how important it is to bust up trust, to bust up big corporations. Well, here's my concern, and I want to lay this out for this hour, is that what we are seeing, we have seen now as a result of the Citizens United decision, big corporations, particularly through the Chamber of Commerce, we're looking at an oligarchy here in the United States. Big corporations and people who got rich via big corporations, like the Koch brothers, taking that money, the corporate money or their personal money, and basically buying politicians or buying policy through, like in the case of the Koch brothers, funding things like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which has been writing all these laws in the various states that disenfranchise African Americans, poor people, young people, old people, so they can't vote, that, you know, make it, that strip the rights of unionized workers, and on it goes. I mean, you know, ALEC's agenda is pretty clear. So, you know, what we've been seeing is working through the Democratic and Republican Party, principally the Republican Party. We had on this program back, I don't know, 3 months ago or so, at the last ALEC meeting was down in, as I recall, New Orleans, and a Democratic lawmaker from Madison, Wisconsin attended. Now, any lawmaker, any state lawmaker can attend for $100. If you're a lobbyist, I think it's $100,000. Maybe it's $10,000. Costs a whole lot more. I think it's $100,000. But if you're a lawmaker, it's only $100. And so basically what they try to do is get a 50-50 balance of lawmakers and lobbyists. And they sit in rooms together and they lay out legislation. So this is an attempt to hijack the political system of America by these corporations and rich people through the Republican Party. And you've seen them do it in Wisconsin. You've seen them do it in Ohio. You've seen them do it in Michigan. You've seen them do it in Texas. You've seen them do it in Florida. We're all familiar with those and others in Virginia and New Jersey and on it goes. So the question is now, are the Wall Street bankers trying to hijack the entire political system? And I believe they are. David Gregory and NBC News over the weekend gave a 20-minute infomercial to a corporation funded apparently by major Wall Street hedge fund guys called Americans Elect. Here's clip 12. This is David Gregory asking one of his many softball questions on this absolutely disgusting interview this weekend.
What happens if you have somebody who's selected? I mean, it could be President Obama, right? I mean, it could be Ron Paul. Mm-hmm. What happens if you have a partisan who's selected and you ultimately don't get to the goal of a nonpartisan ticket?
Well, as a requirement for them to pursue the Americans Elect nomination, they have to reach across the space and form a nonpartisan ticket. You know,
as long as it's balanced.
That's right, as long as it's balanced. So, and you know, we've seen this in the past. There's a lot of talk in 2008 that Senator McCain would run with Senator Lieberman. That was a ticket that couldn't get sold to the party.
Could it also be a popularity contest where somebody could say, I'd like, former General David Petraeus to be president, and I'd like, John Stewart as well. And, I mean, you could have a kind of popularity contest that renders this sort of moot, doesn't it, if neither one of them want to move forward?
I don't think that's the American people take the selection of their president very seriously.
Yeah. So let me answer the question that David Gregory started out by asking, which is what happens if Americans Elect, the Americans Elect is this shadowy group that will not disclose its donors, although it's raised tens of millions of dollars, will not disclose its donors, and is getting on the ballot in all 50 states. And as I said, they got a 20-minute infomercial on NBC this weekend. They've been all over the place. You know, from Huffington Post to the Colbert Report, these guys. And the answer to the question of what if you get, you know, Ron Paul on the ticket or Barack Obama is that they reserve the right, according to their bylaws, to simply say, no, we are not going to go with the person that everybody voted for on our website. And I guarantee you that's to block Ron Paul, because Ron Paul's got a very strong grassroots support. And for that matter, to block President Obama, who has a very strong grassroots support, at least among web activists. So what the hell is Americans Elect? Irregular Times, by the way, has been doing some very good blogging and reporting on this over the years. But Americans Elect is, it came out of this thing called Unity 08. The CEO is Khalil Byrd. The chairman is Peter Ackerman. They go through this list. It's a 501c4 social welfare group, which means they don't have to disclose their donors. Their website retrieved on 9/24/2011, according to Wikipedia, lists Kellen Arno as the national field director and Michael Arno as the ballot access advisor. Michael Arno is the president of Arno Political Consultants. So who is Arno Political Consultants? Arno Political Consultants is a company based in Lincoln, California, founded in 79 by Michael Arno. Their former and current clients include the National Rifle Association and R.J. Reynolds. This from the Wikipedia on Arno Political Consultants. Arno Political Consultants has frequently been the subject of controversy over their bait-and-switch tactics, bribery, forgery, and other types of fraud in gathering signatures. In 2004, they tricked people into registering to vote as a Republican, or they hired JSM, who hired YPM, who is accused of. In 2004, APC is accused of forging signatures in a petition to legalize slot machines in Miami-Dade and Broward County. In 2005, paid signature collectors from APC revealed that an unknown but large number of signatures for a petition to remove the right to same-sex marriage in Massachusetts have been collected through fraud. In 2007, APC hired JSM, Inc., who hired independent contractors who gave snacks and food to homeless people in exchange for signing petitions and registering to vote. But that's not even the beginning of it. The whole idea of this Americans Elect website, this from The Guardian, will allow ordinary Americans to participate in an online convention in June that will pick a presidential candidate to run in the 2012 race. This, in my mind, is an attempt to either promote the interests of Mayor Bloomberg or Evan Bay or something like that, or to basically just blow up our political process, or to make sure that the Republican is elected. I'll give you more details in a few minutes. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what is American Elect all about, and why won't they disclose their donor? Oh, well, because they're shy. They're shy.
But... you just won a half million dollars.
Well, if you had 10 million or 100 million or 1,000 million, a billion or 10,000 million, 10 billion, then maybe you would fund Americans Elect. As Justin Elliott wrote for Salon.com on December 9th, 2011, here's what the group is not so upfront about. It's fueled by millions of dollars in secret money. There's a group of wealthy, well-connected board members who have control over Americans Elect's nominating process, and the group has myriad links to Wall Street. Thomas Friedman, the famous corporatist, who today Dean Baker wrote this brilliant piece yesterday about Thomas Friedman. The headline: Thomas Friedman is flat nonsense at economics in the New York Times. He says the New York Times continues its policy of affirmative action for people ignorant of the world by allowing Thomas Friedman to write two columns a week on whatever he chooses. Today he talks about the job crisis. And he points out Thomas Friedman doesn't know what he's talking about. So anyhow, Thomas Friedman back in July about Americans Elect said, what Amazon did to books, the blogosphere did to newspapers, iPod did to newspaper, drugstore.com did to pharmacies, American Elect plans to do to the two-party duopoly. In other words, they're going to destroy it. I mean, that's not the conclusion Thomas Friedman came to. He thought it was a wonderful thing. They're going to remove the barriers to real competition. Right. Amazon.com removed the barriers to real competition. No, they put a lot of bookstores out of business. With drugstore.com. Well, anyway. The Huffington Post, 2012, the year of the independent. Lynn Forrester de Rothschild writes about this revolutionary new way to nominate a bipartisan ticket to occupy the White House. Who is she? She's a bundler for John Huntsman, who, by the way, is one of the people who they're touting as a possible candidate. It turns out that all of their candidates, first of all, they have to be approved by the Candidate Certification Committee, according to the group's bylaws. And who appoints that? The board of directors. As Thomas Friedman reported over the summer, the group is financed with some serious hedge fund money. They've got some fancy office space in New York and D.C. Peter Ackerman, chairman of the board, gave over $1 million to the group. He's a wealthy investment banker. He was on the board of the Cato Institute's Social Security Choice Project. The Cato Institute, funded by the Koch brothers, the Social Security Choice Project, a program to destroy Social Security and replace it with a privatized system. It's where all the money goes to Wall Street. Maybe that could be because, according to The Guardian, other funders include Melvin Andrews of Lakeside Capital Partners and Kirk Rostron, who formerly worked as a director of Merrill Lynch's hedge fund group. Now, who do they have, who's political? You got former McCain aide Mark McKinnon, Will Marshall of the Progressive Policy Institute, former New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman. She of the, you can go down to 9/11 and breathe the air. It's just fine. And Bloomberg pollster Douglas Schoen, who says, why can't we just all get along by agreeing to dismantle Social Security? No, he didn't say that. This is who what they're saying in Salon, saying suggest the group will promote a kind of pro-establishment. Why can't we just all get along by agreeing to dismantle Social Security-style centrism? This is what they're calling centrism. This is clip 8, David Gregory interviewing these guys over the weekend, giving them basically, you know, saying, bend over, I want to kiss, on NBC nationwide for 20 minutes. Clip 1.
So the key is a nonpartisan ticket. Elliot, why do we need this?
Well, you know, right now we've got a government that isn't working. You know, we're seeing the continued and predictable failure of our elected leaders to reach across the space and work together.
So the answer is to turn it over to a group that won't disclose its donors, is funded by a bunch of Wall Street people, that has ties to Bloomberg and whatnot, that is promoting privatizing, you know, that seems to be promoting privatizing Social Security. Let's turn it over to this group and then have a primary on the internet in June, and everybody can vote. But by the way, if you vote for somebody that they don't like, they're not going to put that person on the ballot. So Ron Paul supporters, Barack Obama supporters, Russ Feingold, but don't bother. It's going to be Evan Bayh or Michael Bloomberg. It's going to be somebody who wants to privatize Social Security. It's somebody who wants to hand America off to Wall Street. I guarantee it. You will see it. Mark my words. Record that. Well, they're being recorded right now. Here's David Gregory, kiss number 2, clip 9.
So tell me how it works. I mean, first of all, you have to get ballot access. How many states have you gotten access to?
Right now, we are on the ballot and certified in 11 states. We are in the process of finishing up 30 states this year. That's the most you can go into in 2011.
And by 2012, the election year, they hope to be in all 50 states, which means that they can run a candidate against both the Republican and the Democrat in every single state. Clip 10.
So are individuals nominating figures they'd like to run, or are, you know, candidates themselves putting themselves, offering themselves up via the website?
Think of it this way. In the normal course of events on a presidential election, the three choices that we have right now, the Democrat and the two Republicans, before Iowa and New Hampshire would be all people would have. Americans Elect changes the calendar by allowing people to envision, since we're getting ballot access, which is the big driver, envision who, what former or sitting governor, what person who's in corporate life, what person who's shown leadership and where they are, who should we be putting forward to allow to run for president?
In other words, David, in answer to your question, how do you decide who's going to run? We have this board of directors made up of millionaires and billionaires who are going to decide. Or it sure looks that way. Americans Elect is the Trojan horse. Look out. Your call's next, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can drop by TomHartman.com. We're going to give away a copy of my new book, The Tom Hartman Reader, to the best message posted today over at TomHartman.com on our message boards.
Rich men in a darkened room making plans with you, the corporate boom. Flowers of evil begin to bloom in a rich man's world.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Cliff in Sioux City, Iowa. Hey, Cliff, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I wanted to put this out here. We're trying to get an Occupy Sioux City type of thing going. We want to march. We're looking at New Year's Eve Day, December 31st.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I got a website that we can be reached at.
Okay, and that is?
It's GoldToothRoy, all one word, at gmail.com.
GoldToothRoy?
Yes.
Okay, at gmail.com. Got it.
And basically what we want to do is, I'm not an organizer. I'm a welder. We need help with this. And
okay.
Also, I want to give out my phone number.
Don't do that, Cliff. Don't do that. You don't want to give out your phone number on national radio. I would suggest that you build a website and come back and give us the website. We have put out your email address, But I, you know, it's like that, even that is a dicey thing to do because you will start getting all kinds of weird spam and things. So, you know, the best thing to do is to put together a website and give us a call back when you've got it. But good luck on building a an Occupy Sioux City organization. I totally support, you know, what you're all about and what you're doing. And Paul in Longview, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's going on?
Hey, Tom, just wanted to give you a Longview Occupy update. We joined forces. We're a very small organization here. We joined forces with many, many helpful people from Portland, from Astoria, from Vancouver. We shut this place down.
Today.
Today. The longshoremen went home with pay, not a single arrest. Only one cop was actually here because of some tricks we played on the local media when we were interviewed. Not one of us can take any credit for this. All of us did this, and we were absolutely successful.
And absolutely peaceful.
Absolutely peaceful. Not a single arrest.
Yeah. Well, good on you. Paul, thank you for the update, and thanks for the information. Great to hear from you. Bob in San Francisco. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Tom, you had a factoid a couple of weeks ago that was just mind-blowing. The amount of debt increase over 20 years or so is exactly equal to the profits or the growth of the banks. In other words, they vampired all of what was made possible by all that leveraging.
I don't recall saying exactly that. I know we've gone through a number of statistics, but there has been, I'm not sure I could make that correlation.
It was the day after the $7.7 billion was revealed to have
trillion. Fallen. Yeah, trillion. $7.7 trillion. Yeah. And,
finally
and,
revealed.
And there's been a $7 trillion loss in wealth by largely the American middle class as a result of the housing crash. But that I'm not sure that there's a one-on-one there. And the Fed has pushed back. Thanks for the call, Bob. The Fed has pushed back and said, you know, that $7.7 trillion, well, you know, you guys are it wasn't all one piece, and we didn't just give it to the banksters. There were rotating amounts. There was pieces here, pieces there. That's what it all added up to. Let's not be simplistic about it, et cetera. So it is not entirely a zero-sum game. There are pieces, moving pieces to it. John in New York City. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, I'm just wondering if you know anything about what's happening with the National Defense Authorization Act and the
– Yeah.
Detention without trial provision for American citizens?
My understanding is that, first of all, the McCain-Levin piece, the detention without trial piece, according to Senator Levin's office, doesn't actually produce detention without trial. But there was a rider that was attached to the Defense Appropriation Act saying that whether it does or it doesn't, it does not change current law. So that's how it went out of the Senate, which is a little reassuring, but not entirely reassuring because current law is still ambiguous. And now that bill then was passed out of the Senate, but it's quite different than the bill in the House, which means the two are going to have to be reconciled when there's a House, Senate reconciliation. When that is done, they will go back to the House and Senate for a vote. At that point in time, we can contact all of our members of Congress once again. And if it is onerous, if it does look like it's turning the U.S. into a battlefield and inviting the U.S. military in, and you can be arrested by the military and held without trial forever, as people are concerned that it may do, then we can all raise hell about it and should. And then if it does get passed by Congress in that form, then it still has to be signed by the president and we can make our voices heard there. So, you know, hang on. This battle is not over. In fact, it's not even, you know, halfway through. Ed in Klamath Falls. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Tom, if you want to understand Americans elect, I'd refer you to about a couple weeks ago on Charlie Rose, the chairman of Americans Elect was on, and he did an in-depth interview where he pretty much described how they intend to steal the election. He said that if they don't have enough votes for a majority in the Electoral College, he's going to direct his candidate, the American Elect candidate, to give his electoral votes to anybody that they choose. And, of course, they're going to choose the Republican, but he didn't say that. Add to it, but he said absolutely he intends to keep it out of the House of Representatives. He will not let the election get thrown into the House, and he will give his electoral votes to whoever he chooses to keep it from getting thrown into the House.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would characterize that as stealing an election. It is certainly influencing an election, Ed. And that's very interesting. I can't comment specifically on that. I didn't see the interview with Charlie Rose. But
like I said, a couple weeks ago on Charlie Rose, anybody that has access to that interview, watch it, and you will understand Americans Elect.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for the information. Appreciate it. Mike in Columbia, Missouri. Hey, Mike, what's happening?
Hi, Tom. I'm not too optimistic about 2012 elections. The latest survey or poll says that the majority of Americans do not believe that Obama should be reelected. And in one sense, on his foreign policy, I agree. But the Republicans are absolutely crazy. So if a Republican does get in, we are screwed. And can you imagine Newt Gingrich as president?
I can't, no. Actually, I can, and it would wake me up at night. it's on the other hand, to a certain extent, the president doesn't have as much power as we think. On the other hand, the president does have the power to appoint members of the Supreme Court. And that's a big deal because the Supreme Court is the most powerful of the three branches of government now and has been since 1803 with Marbury versus Madison. And
yeah, that's very important.
Yeah.
I wish President Obama would be a little bit more aggressive. I think he's too mellow.
Well, I think, a lot of people feel that way. And, time will tell. I have a feeling we've seen him up the volume level several octaves just in the last few weeks. I have a feeling there's more to come, but time will tell. Thank you very much for the call, Mike. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I have a report about what's happening in Seattle, and also a shout out to our friends there in Longview, Washington, because one of the reasons that people are going to the port here in Seattle, mm-hmm. in solidarity with the longshoremen down there in the port of Longview, because there's a company there called EGT that owns the terminal that's been pushing some sort of union-busting kind of policies there. And there's also some of that happening in Los Angeles and in Oakland. So people should know that this is not just a bunch of, crazy, radical students or something. This is actually a group of people who want to go to the ports today and not only express this important thing, which is that the Occupy Wall Street movement is not over. And that wiping out the camps, across the country using police has not ended the movement. But it's also a move of solidarity because the original call-out came from Occupy Oakland. And now all of the ports across the West Coast are participating in these actions today. So I'm really proud of people. I think that, they're definitely showing that they're not going away and that, all of the police repression and other things that have been happening haven't stopped the movement. By the way,
in fact, they fuel
watching it. The live stream. Excuse me?
In fact, they fuel it.
Yeah, I mean, we've been watching the live stream from New York City today, and they went to Goldman Sachs, and then they shortly thereafter got, another experience with police brutality, unfortunately. Mm. Even the person that was hosting the live stream was grabbed by the police, and some reporters were reportedly arrested, including somebody from the Daily News and 15 other people that we know of. We were watching it live as it was happening there. So
wow.
It's not just on the West Coast that, people are marching today, and the Occupy movement is certainly not over.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think that this is what you are seeing, I think, frankly, all around the world, is a young generation, a generation of people, a revolutionary generation. It's the reincarnation of the generation of, and I don't mean literally, but it is, functionally the reincarnation of the generation of the 1770s, of the 1860s, of the 1930s. This is that every 80 years you have a revolutionary time. You have a truly transformational time. And this is a truly transformational time. And I think it's happening around the world. I think you're seeing it in other countries as well. Those politicians who understand it, who get it, and who get behind it are going to come out really, really well. And those who don't are frankly going to lose their power. And so that's the message that I think President Obama is starting to get. And it's also the message that the Republicans have clearly gotten, and which is why they're trying to block everything he's doing.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with the Talk Radio News Service check-in, find out everything that's going on here in D.C., plus your calls. Welcome back to the place where smart people get the news, the Tom Hartman Program. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, on the line with us. Victoria, what's up?
Well, President Obama and Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki were just at Arlington National Cemetery, where they laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns. Prior to that, they held a brief joint press conference where the president talked about America's enormous investment of blood and treasure in Iraq.
And $64 billion, isn't it?
I think it's something like that, yes.
61?
Yeah. He talked about nearly 4,500 fallen Americans who gave their last full measure of devotion, tens of thousands of wounded warriors, and so many inspiring military families. The reason Prime Minister al-Maliki is here, of course, is because we are winding down the war in Iraq and all the military personnel are coming home by the end of this year.
Right, and my cynical take on why he is here is because he wants more money.
Well, that may be the case.
Maybe. I mean, Karzai at least just comes right out and says it. I want more money.
Well, I don't know what happened behind closed doors.
Yeah, okay.
It was an interesting press conference. They talked about the mutual interests that they have. The question of Syria came up in one question. And as you know, we are not necessarily 100% happy with Iraq's position on Syria because they were not completely behind the Arab League's strong actions on Syria, because Iraq does border Syria. So President Obama said that he and al-Maliki were deeply concerned by the Syria government's assault on its own people. Obama talked about his own outrage. He said he was confident that the Iraqi leader's approach to dealing with Syria was based on his own nation's interest, based on what's best for Iraq, not considerations of what Iran would like to see.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Other thing that happened today, this morning, the Supreme Court said this morning that it will review Arizona's restrictive immigration law that has sparked a national controversy.
And also got the author of the law kicked out of office in this last election.
That's correct. Yes, that's correct. And Justice Elena Kagan will recuse herself from this case. So there will be eight justices, which means that Governor Rick Perry of Texas was correct.
Okay.
When he answered the question.
You know, his campaign is now saying that he was referring to a particular case, I forget which case it was, that was decided on an 8-1 basis, and that's what he meant to be talking about.
Of course he did.
Yes.
Yes. I'm sure. The Justice Department challenged state efforts to punish illegal immigrants and successfully blocked the most controversial elements of this Arizona law in lower courts. And it said to the Supreme Court that its intervention wasn't necessary at this time. The Supreme Court disagreed. The administration said the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco was correct to rule that Arizona was trying to take on immigration enforcement that belongs solely to the federal government. Now, Arizona said, oh, no. In fact, the border state was feeling the brunt of a broken immigration system, and its law was intended to cooperate with federal laws to control illegal immigration, not to usurp the federal government's power. But when Arizona Governor Jan Brewer signed the law, she described it as a way for her state to, quote, solve a crisis we did not create and the federal government has refused to fix. Which is quite interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Particularly given that President Obama has arrested and deported more, quote, illegal immigrants, end quote, than any other president in the history of the United States.
That's right. 1.2 million illegal immigrants in the first 3 years of his administration, compared with 1.57 million during all 8 years of President George W. Bush's administration.
Right.
So, yes, quite a lot, actually.
Jen
so,
Brewer speaks with forked tongue, as they say.
Maybe indeed she does. So it's going to be a very interesting year next year because, of course, we've got the health care case, which will take 2 days of hearings. We've got this, and we've also got the court saying on Friday that it's going to intervene in this very partisan battle over Texas redistricting. So it's going to be very lively in the Supreme Court next year.
Yeah. Apparently.
And very political.
Yes. It'll be very interesting to see how this goes. Because, you know, in some ways this may backfire. It's like Citizens United, the court's so overreached that you now have a national anti-corporate personhood movement that's actually taking power. You know, Bernie Sanders over at sanders.senate.gov has over 100,000 signatures now on his petition to amend the Constitution. And it's happening. Ted Deutch in the House of Representatives, same thing. And if they overreach next year on these highly political issues during a political campaign, it may drive more people to say, you know, I really think that I want, you know, to cause people to start thinking of presidential nominees in terms of this person I'm going to vote for because they're going to appoint the next Supreme Court justices.
Well, I think that's right. I think that the Supreme Court will come very much to the fore as an issue.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, indeed. Meantime, back at the ranch, that mm-hmm. would be Congress. Mm-hmm. The payroll tax extension looks like being up for a vote tomorrow in the House and is likely to pass with the Keystone XL pipeline attached to it, which is quite a long attachment.
That's because the House is Republican-controlled. It'll go nowhere in the Democratic Senate.
Exactly, which is exactly what Harry Reid said. Meanwhile, today, you should know that the House this afternoon will be debating four post office naming bills.
Oh, they're doing really important stuff.
Yes.
Are they naming them all after Ronald Reagan?
Don't know.
I'll bet.
It's a popular one.
Yeah. We'll see. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
And great. Brought to you by the way, Ellen Ratner's new book, Self-Empowerment. Up next, I'm having a rumble about taxi millionaires and kicking conservative butts. Somebody has to do it. Stick around.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So the Republicans, John Thune, for example, the senator from South Dakota, has said that if taxes go up on millionaires, keep in mind the Democrats are proposing to extend about $1,000 a year per person for the average working person tax cut by reducing the payroll tax, to extend this for another year and to pay for this, because they try, unlike George W. Bush with his wars and Medicare Part D and all this other stuff, this administration actually pays for things. To pay for this, they want to tax anybody on their income with an extra 3% roughly income tax after their first $1 million. So on their million and one dollar per year. And John Thune said, if you do that, they're going to stop hiring people. So Tamara Keith with Morning Edition on NPR notes that for the second week in a row, Senate on Thursday voted down proposals to extend the, you know, blah, blah, blah. And she quotes John Thune. She says, we went to the business groups who've been lobbying against the surtax. 3 days after putting in the request, none of them was able to find someone for us to talk to. So we put a query on Facebook. Several business owners who said they would be affected by the millionaire surtax responded. Ian Yankwit, who owns Tortoise Investment Management, said, it's not one of the top 20 things we think about when we're making a business hire. He says his ultimate marginal tax rate wouldn't even make it on the agenda. Jason Berger, a multimillionaire, co-owner of CSS International Holdings, global infrastructure contractor, makes more than $1 million a year. He said, if my taxes go up, I have slightly less disposable income. Yes, I only think it's fair that I put back into the system that is the entire reason for my success. He says his Michigan-based company is hiring like crazy, and he'd be perfectly willing to pay the surtax. So why would anybody oppose it? Mark Finkelstein is on the line with us. He's with newsbusters.org, the conservative website. And, Mark, I don't get it. Why do you think that going, you know, when Bill Clinton raised taxes 3% and Newt Gingrich stood on the floor of the House of Representatives, not a single Republican voted for it, and Newt Gingrich prophesied that it would produce a Great Depression within the year, and instead it produced 20 million new jobs and an explosion in economic activity, when we had four decades of 3.2% or higher growth, the only time in the history of the United States when decade-to-decade GDP growth has been more than 3.2%, we're all, when the top tax rate on millionaires and billionaires was above 74%, as soon as it dropped, it went below 3.2%. How can you do anything other than look at the math and say, gee, we ought to roll back the Reagan tax cuts?
You know, Tom, I often hear you saying that you and other progressives love science and love the scientific method, but, you know, you're sounding like the rooster who's trying to take credit for the sunrise because he's crowed. In other words, it's not a controlled experiment to say that during a given time we had growth and taxes were higher. That doesn't prove that higher taxes produce growth. I would say to the contrary, we'd have to see how much higher the growth would have been if taxes had been kept lower. And I just find it amusing that, you know, you're saying that President Obama and Democrats want to, you know, pay for things. I truly do not believe that these are suddenly, you know, newborn, born-again deficit hawks. These are folks who simply want to get hold of more money out of the private
sector. Mark, first of all,
that's what it's really about.
Mark, you are mischaracterizing what I'm saying. I'm not suggesting that higher taxes produce growth, although I am willing to make that argument. What I explicitly just said was that during times of high taxes, we had growth. I don't think that there's an absolute connection between the two, other than that, if you have tax rates on people who earn over $1 million below 50%, then what you tend to see is bubble economies emerge, not just in the United States, but all over the world. And there are dozens of examples of this, and this is very well documented in the literature of economics. And that when you have tax rates above 50% after the first $1 million, that you tend not to see bubble economies because you don't have so much hot money. You don't have cheap money where people are looking for high, fast returns, high risk returns, you know, flowing around in the economy. And you certainly have seen that in the United States. You had a 91% tax rate in 1920. Harding came into office in 1921 and dropped it down to 25%. And over the next 9 years, you had an explosive bubble economy from 1921 to 1929. That bubble popped in 29, and it took us a decade to get out of that. Again,
Tom, if you want to let me get in a word itch right
sure.
here. I mean, if you want to talk about bubble economies, the one that has caused the present crisis is the one that was created by direct government intervention through the, you know, the Fannie Mae's and the Freddie Mac's and the various government intrusion into the markets. That
the entire
all of these wait a sec, let me just finish.
Mark, you know, you're wrong. Your numbers are wrong.
Trillions of dollars into the real estate market, inflated prices irrationally, lent money to people who couldn't handle it, and inevitably.
Mark, what was the size of the total subprime market?
Say again?
How many dollars? What was the size of the total subprime market in the United States that you're saying was responsible for the crash? How big was it?
Hundreds of billions.
I'll tell you, it was $1.7 trillion.
Okay, there you go.
It's $1,700 trillion.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the Fed put $7.7 trillion into the system. Now, what was the size of the gray market in CDOs, CDSs, and other derivatives before 1990? Versus 2008 when it crashed.
But
before 1990, it was zero.
I don't have the figure on the tip of my tongue, but Tom, the point
before 1998, it was zero because they were illegal. When they crashed in 2008, it was $800 trillion. An $800 trillion crash that is now down to $600 trillion has nothing to do with $1.7 trillion in subprime mortgages. The subprime mortgages are not what crashed the economy.
Tom, this is something we discussed last time, that here's an area that we agree, that government should not be in the business of corporate welfare, that, you know, there is no...
Government should be in the business of regulating banks.
No,
when we stopped regulating them in 1998, all this happened.
No, above all, government should be in the business of telling everybody, from banks to investors to depositors, that if you make foolish or risky or irresponsible loans or investments, you are the one that's going to be on the hook, and Big Mama government is not going to come along to help you out. And that it will be the force of the market, much more than any government regulation, that will result in people making responsible decisions.
You know, Mark, if we were talking about manufacturing widgets, I would agree with you. But what you're talking about, when you're talking about the banking system, is you're talking about the livelihood of millions of Americans. What you're talking about is a result of this deregulation of the banksters and this destruction of the banking system is that people are committing suicide, people are getting divorces, child abuse and spouse abuse is up, mental illness is up, people are dying, people are homeless. This is all the result of the fact that Phil Graham, in large part, but it was the tail end of the Clinton administration for, you know, to make it bipartisan, but it was largely a Republican effort, deregulated the banks, you know, by doing away with Glass-Steagall, with Graham-Leach-Bliley. And this, you know, if it wasn't the banking system, I'd agree with you, but this is something that affects people's lives.
I would say it is the end result of big government intervention that began with things like the FDIC. And if again, from
the FDIC
day one,
was created in 1935, it prevented
a
disaster.
Exactly. And that is the point, that if people understood from day one that there is no such thing as, you know,
the FDIC only protects people up to $150,000. How could that possibly have anything to do with a $600 trillion black market?
That was the beginning of this whole slippery slope that led to greater and greater government involvement in the markets and ultimately created this huge bubble that burst.
That's nonsense, Mark. We never, before 1935, the United States had literally never gone more than 15 years without a major national banking panic. Since, from 1935 until Phil Graham got his legislation through in 99, we did not have a single major national banking panic. Not one. 50 years. And then he deregulated it, and boom, within a decade, we were back to the exact same cycles we were in before we had regulated banks.
But again, I'm sure you would agree that it was government intervention that led to the housing bubble and ultimate collapse.
No, it had nothing to do with it. It was the lack of government regulation, in my opinion. I get it that your opinion is the other way around. Mark Fink, and people can read about it at newsbusters.org. Mark Finkelstein. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what caused the great crash of now, of 2008, the Bush Great Depression?
Obama be thy name, thy change shall come, thy will be done, as it is in American dream. It is Obama for the White House, all the way from Illinois.
Exposing the con and conservative. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Daryl Pope, with the he's the president of the local chapter of the NAACP in Hutchinson, Texas. And Daryl, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you. This is Hutchinson, Kansas.
Did I say Texas?
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry. I misspoke. Kansas. You're right. Hutchinson, Kansas. And I understand that there's a Tea Party group in Hutchinson, Kansas, that has just, I don't know what they've been drinking or smoking or whatever they do at these Tea Party groups, but they've just gone off the rails. Do I have that right?
Apparently it's something, because they have gone off the rail. The statement that they come out with on their website with the skunk thing concerning the President of the United States was really off the rail, and so it's one of those kind of situations that is another reminder of where we are as far as the country's concerned.
So recap this for our viewers and listeners who may not know what you're talking about.
Well, there's a group here, a Tea Party group here, that had a website on, and their website, they had a picture of a skunk, and it says that the skunk has replaced the eagle as far as the insignia for the President of the United States. It said because it's half black and half white, and everything that it does stinks. And they had that on their website, and so it caused some kind of, you know, some ill feeling, and I feel like it was racist and offensive, and
yep.
It was a malicious effort to, here again, take another strike at our president.
Have they stepped back from this?
I'm sorry?
Have they stepped back from that position, or is that still up there?
They've stepped back. It's no longer on the website.
Yeah. I'm curious your thoughts. We're talking with Daryl Pope. He's the president of the local chapter, Hutchinson, Kansas, of the NAACP. I'm curious your take on to what extent racism is alive and well in America and playing a role in national politics. I've seen polls, for example, that suggest that the white racist anti-Obama, simply because he's African-American, vote might have represented somewhere between 3 and 5% of the vote, where people otherwise would have voted for a Democrat. They voted against him because of race. Do you think that that's a reasonable number? Do you think it's larger than that, smaller than that? Clearly there are regional differences. I'd just love to hear your thoughts on this.
I think it's even a little larger than that. I think that when you look at the publicity and the kinds of things that have been, I don't remember, and I've been around a while, and I don't remember in my history any president ever receiving the kind of disrespect and that this president has received.
Yes.
And especially if you live in conservative Kansas, you know that we're inundated with that kind of negative type thing. And so to answer your question, I would say that I think it's even a little worse than that.
Do you think that the attempts to characterize President Obama, more than half of Fox viewers, for example, believe that he's a Muslim or might be a Muslim, that the attempts to characterize him as something other than a Christian he's been characterized as a rich guy who won't send his kids to the public schools in Washington, D.C. That attack was made, class attacks. So there's religious attacks and class attacks. Do you see these as different ways to try to attack him in addition to the racial attack? Or do you see these as deriving from, most Muslims are not white Anglo-Saxon Caucasians, do you see these as just other dimensions of racial attacks, of racism?
Absolutely. I think that they're groping for anything that they can find that might be negative as far as he's concerned. I think that...
But is it code for race?
Yes, it definitely, very definitely.
Yeah, that's my sense of it, too.
I think if a guy put on a red sock instead of blue socks, that would be a problem for him. But I think they're just groping at whatever they can find to be negative.
Now, it seems to me that the good news is, Daryl Pope, that people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and older remember a time of racial segregation in the United States, and many of them still carry both the scars and, in some cases, the attitudes from that. But it certainly seems that people in their teens and 20s and 30s, the younger people, are much less inclined to see race, as it were. Is that just me being Pollyanna and my limited sense from, my listeners and my own children who are in that age, or is that something that you're seeing as well?
That's true. That's a fact. You're right in the sense that these younger folks haven't experienced it or been exposed to it as some of us older people have been.
Yeah, and therefore they don't carry the attitudes. There's less racism in other words among younger generations than the older generations on both sides.
I don't know if there's less, but it's not as overt as it was in the past. But I think that you still find pockets where that it's very prevalent.
Yeah. So what can we have just a minute left? What can we all do about this, Daryl Pope?
One of the things that I think we can do is one of the things I've experienced is when there's something happening, when somebody's talking about, in other words, black folks, so to speak. Well, I found out that when somebody that looks like you, a white person, tells another person that they find that offensive, or that they find these stereotypes and these statements, mythical statements made about black folks, when they start telling them that they find it offensive and it's not true, well, then that makes people kind of set up and take notice, because they expect me to say it, but they don't expect it to come from one of their cronies or one of their associates.
Right.
And so, I think that that's what it's going to take. It's going to take more people explaining the fact that it's offensive to degrade or downgrade a person simply on the color of their skin.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think more and more people are willing to call out racism for what it is, and that's a good and healthy thing in our society. And Daryl Pope, kudos to you for doing so in Hutchinson, Kansas, where the Tea Party ad tried to portray President Obama as a skunk. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Good luck and keep up the good work. The NAACP is one of the great organizations out there.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, your calls and thoughts and the good, the bad, and the incredible new vocabulary word, ugly. That's the good, the bad, and the very, very Corman-natively ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com. The good, San Francisco. Beginning next year, the city will be the first in the nation to have a minimum wage above $10. On January 1st, the new minimum wage in San Francisco will be $10.24, more than $2 above the state of California's minimum wage and nearly $3 above the federal minimum wage. That's because San Francisco recognized the basic economic truth. Rich people aren't the job creators. Working people are. And the more money working people have in their pockets to spend, the more jobs that are created. Time to take San Francisco's lead and raise the minimum wage all around the country. The bad. Rick Perry. If you want to be the Republican candidate for president, then make sure you're up to date on what is the latest White House controversy manufactured by Republicans. And Rick Perry did his homework, sort of. Name-dropping the so-called Solyndra Green Energy Loan Scandal that has been incessantly hyped over at GOP TV and on the right-wing blogosphere. Only instead of identifying Solyndra as a failed green energy company, Perry referred to it as a country, saying, no greater example of it than this administration sending millions of dollars into the solar industry, and we lost that money. I want to say it was over $500 million that went to the country Solyndra. The country, Solyndra? Where exactly is that country, Governor? What's the capital? Who's the president? Oh, well, maybe we should give the governor a break. After all, the country of Solyndra is just as manufactured as the scandal of Solyndra. Anyway. And the very, very ugly John McLaughlin. The host of the weekly show known as the McLaughlin Group gave his take on President Obama's Teddy Roosevelt speech last week. And it appears he got his talking points from GOP TV's Fox so-called news, referring to the speech in which President Obama said our nation is better off thanks to things like unemployment insurance, the 8-hour work week, and progressive income tax. McLaughlin said, did President Obama sound more like Teddy Roosevelt or more like Hugo Chavez? Right. It's giving help to the unemployed and making sure the rich pay their fair share, which is what our nation has done for the better part of the last 70 years, is exactly what Chavez is up to in Venezuela. I guess that means America has a long list of so-called socialist presidents. Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford. Shall I continue? Simply put, conservatives today try to paint our greatest accomplishments as a nation over the last 100 years as socialist? That's very, very ugly. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, and Denver in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Denver, what's on your mind today?
Well, I had a few things on my mind. The main one being that President Obama, God bless his soul, he may have had great intentions. I don't know the man. I don't know his mind. But he said change you could believe in. Well, anything, any kind of change, you know, would be better than what Bush did to us. Bush literally took us down the drain. Yeah. But I'm 55 years old. I was born the son of a coal baron in East Kentucky, and I saw, beginning with Nixon, Nixon was actually the genesis of what you're seeing right now in the government. My father and his cohorts in the coal industry took $5 million to Nixon when the oil embargo started. Overnight, coal went from $7 to $70 a ton. And therein began the control, complete control by lobbyists of our government.
You know, I'm not surprised by that. We know from public records and a lawsuit that the milk industry bribed Richard Nixon.
The lust of money. It comes down to the lust of money. I'm not going to, you know, I'm a Christian, and I'm not going to hit on, you know, anything like that except to say, beware of anyone who says, God told me to do this.
Yeah.
I'm a Christian. My God does not speak to me. My Jesus speaks to me. He's my Lord. But if they're listening to God, which God is it? God of hellfire, maybe. Nevertheless, getting back to my point.
Yeah.
My point was, until we extinguish lobbyists and the money factor, then you're never going to correct this country. This country will never correct itself.
Now, I've got to move along, Denver. Thank you for the call. Well said. Yeah, and you're right. And the problem is the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court has said that you can't do anything about lobbyists, you can't do anything about money, and that's why we need this constitutional amendment and that you can sign up for at sanders.senate.gov. Dominic in San Pedro, California. Hey, Dominic.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Great. What's up?
I just wanted to call, and I know a lot of longshoremen listen to your show, but I just want to get the word out to them. There's a lot of them that probably don't understand the Occupy movement is on their side, but there's a lot of them that do, and if we can get them really mobilized, right now they're ambivalent, they could be a real strong ally. I mean, they could change things because they're really the strongest union in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. I absolutely agree, and hopefully a lot of them are listening. Dominic, thank you very much. Well said. Dylan in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hey, Dylan, what's up?
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. I'm calling in response to your guest from Kansas who mentioned something on race and Obama.
Yes.
And I've been doing some reading about that recently. I'm a white 25-year-old from Oklahoma in the Midwest. And what I really have learned is that we have a broad racial illiteracy, and that with Obama's presidency, the idea that racial inequality in the U.S., there's this big belief that that went away.
Yeah.
And that simply isn't the case.
No. There's an absolute screaming disaster happening in the African-American community in the United States. Unemployment rates are double what they are in the white community.
Exactly. And various other things, access to education,
yep.
Being one of those, healthcare, housing, all of those different things. But what I wanted to point out is that I think young liberals are finally recognizing that the lies of our parents' generation, the idea of colorblind racism or a colorblind society is what's optimal. That concept has to be overthrown. We have to recognize that color does exist and that racial inequality does exist, and that it's up to our generation to bridge those gaps where we don't just find equality, but racial equity as well, equity in education and in jobs and all of those.
And do something about it, because one of the biggest problems that we have, Dylan, is that you have 400 years of oppression, apartheid, slavery, and at the same time, on the white side, you have 400 years of the steady accumulation of a wide variety of types of equity, intellectual equity, emotional equity. I'm not sure what you would call it, the ability to stand straight equity, right? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And financial equity. And that's why about 8 to 10% of African Americans, when they buy their first home, get help from their family to make the down payment, whereas about 50% of white people, when they buy their first home, get help from their family. That's why the average wealth of African-American families in the United States right today is less than $10,000, whereas the average wealth of white families in the United States is in the neighborhood of $80,000. This is, you know, some people refer to this as white privilege. And I got to tell you, most white people don't understand this. It's like, you know, just like most people don't realize that the air that they're breathing is all around them and that it's actually a gas. And you know what I mean? It's like, it's just, they don't get it. When Louise and I were kids, there was, you know, as a result of what Martin Luther King was doing in the high schools, there was black awareness classes that were happening. And we learned about these things. Our kids did not and don't. And therefore, it's very easy for people like Limbaugh to preach this siren song of, oh, it's all, everything's all, you know, there's no more, you know, racism, sexism, fill in the blank, which is just total BS. If you look at the subprime mortgages, for example, 50% of all the African Americans who applied for mortgages during the 8 years after the deregulation of the mortgage market in 1999, 50% of those people who got subprime mortgages actually qualified for prime mortgages and were never informed of it. And instead, they got exploding mortgages that blew up in their faces. Why? Because it was more profitable and because they were African-American. And in large part, it wasn't overt racism. It was that this was the first time anybody in their family had ever bought a house, and they didn't know how to deal with a mortgage,
right?
which is white privilege thing.
Right. And I think young people are starting to recognize that this isn't about old-fashioned racism. This is about systemic racism.
Yes.
This is about racism based and within systems. And it's about finding the policies and finding the attitudes that propagate this kind of discrimination and inequality.
Yes.
And correcting those.
Yes.
And that recognizing that white privilege doesn't mean that we should feel white guilt and somehow act as though we're powerless in our situation, but recognizing that we have to take on the history that we've inherited, and we have to do what's right for the world today that we find ourselves
there
in.
There is a space for and a reason for affirmative action.
Right.
I mean, I think that's the, you know, in summary, if I may just summarize what you just said, because we have to make things right. That doesn't mean necessarily 40 acres and a mule. That time is gone.
Right.
But affirmative action in many different ways, and that is not the right-wing stereotype of lowering standards. It is rather things like making tests that work for all races, or making sure that people who didn't have the cultural or economic background to get them to a certain place are given the opportunity to get to that place. And it just blows my mind to hear right-wingers say, oh, you know, those days are gone, and to, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Dylan, very, very thoughtful. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate thoughtful perspective on the issue. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, a crazy alert. The legacy of the King of Pop goes round and round and round.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, Tom Hartman here with you. Our crazy alert for the day. The legacy of the King of Pop goes round and round and round. A few locks of hair belonging to Michael Jackson were sold for nearly $11,000 after fierce online bidding war. Walking away with the hair and the gambling website known as OnlineGamblingPal.com. According to their website, they plan to use Jackson's hair, which was found in a hat belonging to the late pop icon, to make a roulette ball. The company claims the roulette ball made with Jackson's hair will be crafted to the highest professional standards. And that considering Jackson dedicated his life to entertaining millions, the prospect of this very special ball captivating crowds at roulette tables seems like a fitting use for it. Not to be outdone, Donald Trump has now pledged to donate his so-called hair for use in his casinos. But don't expect the Trump hair roulette ball to ever land on black. Plus, Spicoli is getting a free book today for posting a great comment in our message forums. Regulation is just another form of policing, he said. I think we need to tie the words together. What do you think? I agree. Regulations are policing the banksters. So a signed copy of the Tom Hartman Reader will be coming your way soon. And thanks for posting over on our message board. It is appreciated. Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom, in response to the guest you had on that was trying to blame Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac for the subprime crisis.
Yes.
Anytime someone does that to you, I'd like you to ask them if they know what a qualifying loan is. Anybody who's bought a house knows what the term qualifying loan. And what that means is that the loan is qualified for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to buy it. And what that also means to be qualified is that you had to have a job. You had to have a down payment. These were things that were necessary for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to buy it. Therefore,
in other words, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were not involved in the ninja loans and the subprime loan business.
Never were. They never were. The only time they even came close is when Congress, from lobbying from the investment banks, Congress mandated that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac lower their standards to buy more mortgage-backed securities that contain subprime loans.
Hmm.
So they never were involved. Just ask them the qualifying loan is what was required, and that's where the term came from.
Okay.
So it was always the private label mortgages.
Right. So to be clear, Dave, the number of qualifying loans or qualified loans that were underwritten by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac was zero.
The qualified loans were the ones that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac could buy.
Excuse me, the unqualified ones. The number of unqualified ones.
Which was what subprime meant.
Right.
Subprime was subprime credit, and this is where people had no jobs. The stated income loans where it was never checked into, and
right.
they had no down payment, more importantly. And I have one other thing just to get ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
I'd like you and your listeners to look up the term rehypothecation. And this will be the next big thing. This is what's involved with MF Global and why the clients lost their money. And guess what? Bank of America, Wells Fargo, almost all the major banks are involved in rehypothecation. And hypothecation is similar to a mortgage where you pledge your house as collateral.
Right.
That's hypothecation. Rehypothecation is where the banks use the assets deposited in their accounts to back bets in derivatives.
Oh, geez.
And so
they're going to use, in other words, the money in my savings account is going to be used
correct.
The way. Oh, man.
That's what happened to MF Global. That was a brokerage account, but very much like a bank. Farmers, industries kept their collateral in cash in there, and the farmers used the commodity markets legitimately. They were a commodity broker.
Right.
They kept cash accounts. That cash is now missing. No, it's not missing. What happened to it? It went over to the UK through a subsidy of MF Global. They're UK based. It was pledged as margin in derivatives trades. That's what happened. That was rehypothecation.
And those derivative trades went south.
All made legal through the late 1990s with the changes.
Right.
But more importantly, in 2005 with the Bush bankruptcy bill, that put derivatives traders ahead of everyone else in a bankruptcy.
Wow.
They're ahead of bondholders. They're ahead of everyone. They collect any assets before anyone else.
Wow.
That means right now Bank of America has placed $80 trillion worth of derivative trades into their general banking arm right now. Just did this. And that it essentially puts all customer accounts, all deposits at risk.
Which might be what, you know, I was looking at, you know, there was this day of, or this week of, you know, move your money out of the big banks, and it was hundreds of billions of dollars got moved out of the big banks. And I'm thinking, there's no way that average consumers are moving that kind of money out of big banks into small local banks and into credit unions. It's got to be that there's a whole bunch of rich people or a whole bunch of institutional investors who are looking at these, you know, 6, 7, 8 too big to fail major institutions. Top 6 banks have assets equal to 65% of our GDP. They got to be looking at them going, wait a minute, this is no longer a good bet.
Correct. And there's also another caveat to that bankruptcy law. They put in place a clawback provision such that even if you just were lucky or knew that things looked unstable and pulled your money out of the bank, if you did that and then within 90 days the bank fails, they can claw back the money from you.
You're kidding.
Nah, absolutely not. Look this up. Like I say, Google News, it's all over. It's in routers now.
That's
hedge fund.
Incredible. Dave, time to get your money out of the big banks. Man, amazing. Dave, thank you for that. I will check this stuff out. I appreciate the call. I appreciate the tip. Coming up tomorrow, I'll challenge Libertarian and former vice presidential candidate Wayne Root about why he – actually, I think he ran for president on the Libertarian ticket – but why he hates the idea of a millionaire surtax detailed in his new article, I Am the 1%. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you get active, when you participate. Tag, you're it. Occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartmann. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartmann.com.